You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And in the first hour of the show today, we're going to talk about improving your soil with the use of pellets made from locally sourced wool. A couple of Wisconsin residents and business partners with us today, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew. Their business is called Woolets, and it's based in Argyle, Wisconsin. Elaine's an educator, prairie enthusiast, with a degree in environmental science. And Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here. Karen is a fiber artist and a shepherd and a fourth-generation farmer with a background in large-market vegetable farming. And Karen, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. We can take some gardening questions because these folks know prairies and they know vegetables and both know flowers, so we can take those kinds of questions. But we also want to talk about their wool pellets. They're called Woolets. I'm wondering if you ever had wool in your garden. Probably not. Maybe not anyway. What questions do you have about wool pellets? What other gardening questions do you have as we move along today? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Elaine, just to start, you're quite a prairie enthusiast.
Yes, my husband and I have two prairies that span across our yard, and we just love going out to collect seeds and spread them out, and I also start prairie seeds, prairie starts from seeds using Woolets, and then give them a couple of years and then transplant them into the prairie.
Oh, wonderful. And Karen, you have a pretty good-sized vegetable garden.
I do. I would like it to be bigger, but I don't have much flat space on my property.
Yeah.
I do have a little bit of prairie, but I'll admit my sheep eat it more often than not.
Okay, so, and you did have you were involved in commercial vegetable
production. Yes. When I was younger, my family had a very large farm in Maryland, and we used to ship semi-truckloads of fresh veggies up every summer to big cities like Baltimore and Washington, D.C. and New York City and Philly.
So a lot of experience there. And now we've got these Woolets, which are 100% raw wool pellets for horticulture use. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But how did you get this started anyway?
Well, I've been looking at this as an opportunity for the last couple of years, ever since I heard about the first wool pellet mill that was developed in Germany about 10 years ago. And when I was really ready to take the next step and make the leap, I was telling Elaine about it.
And when Karen first told me about it, I realized how beneficial this could be for the entire planet, for the Earth, as an alternative to peat use.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is such a fantastic idea.
Well, peat moss, I mean, there's a lot of concern about the use of peat moss in horticulture, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Peat is the most efficient carbon sink we have on the earth. It covers about 3% of the earth, but it can store 33% of the carbon that we create. But it's unsustainable because it takes thousands of years to develop. And it can be destroyed in a fraction of that amount of time. So people need to find alternatives to using peat, and wool could be the answer.
Well, I looks like it can be. Looks like it is. I've got a bag of your Woolets in front of me. I'm sorry. Describe what is a Woolet.
Well, we start with raw wool straight off the sheep. We shred it in our shredder, also called a wool crusher. And her name is Wilma, and she has 9 whirling blades of death. You don't want to get your fingers in there. And then after the wool is shredded or crushed, we put it in our pellet mill, and her name is Betty. And Betty shoots out the pellets after heating them up to 180 degrees. So that kills off any weed seeds. And then the lanolin that is in the raw wool melts in that heat and binds the pellets together, shoots them out the other end, and then when they cool and harden, they're ready to go.
And I'm trying to think of this. They're pellets. They're small. They look like a pellet from maybe
rabbit food.
Rabbit food, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it looks like. And I opened the bag and took a smell right away because I wanted to see how it's not a
smells like sheep.
smells a little like sheep. The research that you must have did you do some research on this?
We did. I'm going to let Elaine talk about
that. Okay, Elaine, yeah. Talk about that.
There have been some studies done looking at wool for moisture retention and nutrient release. The University of Vermont has done a study, Ohio State University. Those are two that have run trials involving wool. They found that when put up against typical fertilizer protocols, wool gave increased yields and even halved the amount of time it took from seed to market-ready harvest, especially with tomatoes. In the Ohio study, using traditional protocol, greenhouses could bring organic tomatoes from seed to market-ready harvest in about 76 days. But with wool pellets and their nitrogen punch, you could bring tomatoes market-ready in as little as 38 days.
So that's a big difference. And the difference, why? They must have said why.
They believe it's because of the nitrogen punch.
And if you look at you've done your research on the nitrogen, potassium, no phosphorus, which is great because most of our soils have plenty of phosphorus anyway, and in some places like Madison, you're not supposed to use it or
exactly legacy phosphorus. Yeah, is what we call it in the farmland. I have it at my farm as well. We can't add anything more. But wool has less than 1%. It's just trace elements of phosphorus.
And then how much nitrogen?
Nitrogen averages between 9 and 14%. So that is three times the amount in chicken manure. But because there's no urea in the wool, you're not getting any kind of fertilizer burn. So it's a big pop.
Yeah, it would be. And then potassium?
About 2%.
About 2%. Mm-hmm. So... And this is not like putting some commercial fertilizer on because if I'm not, it's just kind of a slow release, correct?
Very slow, and it breaks down over time, releasing all the nutrients. So it's perfect. It won't burn your plants or the roots either.
And also, it's aerating the soil while it's breaking down and releasing those nutrients.
So, and I would think, talk about the water and the water retention that may be involved here. Elaine, go ahead.
So wool is moisture balancing, and I like to say wool is magical. It has characteristics that are polar opposites. Wool is hygroscopic, which means water absorbing, while at the same time it's hydrophobic, which means it repels water. And because of these two seemingly conflicting characteristics, wool will help your plants better handle the wild swings that we're seeing due to climate change.
So it'll retain water better.
So peat generally the accepted rate for water retention for peat is 15 to 20% its own weight. Wool holds 30 times its weight in moisture. And it holds that and then releases it slowly. And because it balances according to the environment it's in, if you have too wet soil, we get one of those torrential rains we were having at the beginning of the summer, it grabs that water and holds it away from the roots so the roots get air and they can breathe and they're not drowning. And then it will release it back as it dries. So you can water about 25% less using wool in your soil.
That's a pretty big number, and not only if you have it out in your garden, but I would think it'd be great for pots and potted plants.
Yes, I had an experiment at my place earlier this spring when I planted some purple beans.
Mm-hmm.
I planted one pot with Woollett's and one pot without, and the soil medium was exactly the same. When I put the seeds in and the soil in, I did not realize that in the wool pellets pot, I didn't have any drainage holes. Yep. So I thought, oh, this is going to be a big problem. But it turned out to be great because it was a great example of the fact that we had torrential rains at the time, and the pot that had the Woollett's not only germinated faster, produced better plants and many more beans, but because of all that water that was in there, the wool absorbed the water. Whereas the other pot that had the holes in it, it was drenched all the time. And those plants, the beans, looked sickly because they just couldn't handle the amount of water that was being retained in the soil, where the wool pulled the moisture away from the roots.
It sounds great. Dale asked, Dale in Mauston called, couldn't stay with us, but asked how the wool pellets affect the pH of the soil.
Wool is, our test with the UW Soil and Forage Lab came up with wool at about 8, so it's pretty close to neutral.
Okay, so...
But we have been looking into some research that says actually wool is one of those materials that can both acidify and turn more base, alkali or whatever. I have to look up the research on it.
Yeah, I'm going to take a look at that. And Marianne in Belgium, she just asked if these pellets can be used in houseplants. And,
Absolutely.
There's that. Bonnie in Wanakee, here's just a plant question. Bonnie in Wanakee emailed, she has some perennials that she plans to transplant this fall. With the warmer weather, is it still okay to transplant perennials in the next few weeks?
Oh, absolutely. I haven't even started working on moving my perennials around. And I do throw in wool pellets around them when I'm planting them in. It helps avoid transplant shock. Seems to protect the plants from that and keeps the soil moist around them while they get settled. Also, those pellets will break down completely over the winter. And by spring, when the plants are waking up and ready to work again, they will have those nutrients already available in the soil.
Perfect. Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew are our guests today. Their business is called Woollett's. They make wool pellets that can be used as an alternative to peat moss. And, of course, they're both gardeners, both prairie gardens as well as vegetable gardens and flower gardeners as well. So you can call in with your questions maybe about the wool pellets, but also about other plants, about the plants as well as we move along. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew, a couple of Wisconsinites who have a business called Woollett's. They make wool pellets that can be used as an alternative to peat moss. And we've heard about their fertilizing advantages and also about their water retaining value as well, as we talked with them. It's great to have them here. You can join in. Maybe you've got a question about the pellets, or maybe you've got a question about your plants. Give us a call. 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And just to mention, in the second hour of Garden Talk today, we'll take a look at heirloom apples with Dan Bussey. Dan's originally from Edgerton, Wisconsin, and he's authored a 7-volume book. It's titled The Illustrated History of Apples in the United States and Canada. So looking forward to talking with him as well. Dave in Appleton has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Actually, I've got two questions. One is, organic farmers have to follow very strict rules and what they use to plant their produce with. Can they use these pellets? And the second question is, can I use just regular wool around my plants if I have the availability.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, thanks for calling in, Dan. The answer to both of your questions is yes. Yes, you can. We have been approved for organic farmers to use, organic growers, by MOSA, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And then also, I myself have been using my fleeces in the ground in my garden and around my trees and wherever for years. The pellets make it a little bit easier to use. You know, they're much more convenient to store and don't take up as much space. They also break down a lot faster. So if you're putting wool directly into your soil around your transplants or whatever, it's going to take a couple of seasons to break down, whereas the pellets will break down in 6 to 12 months. Also, make sure you don't till anything with the wool still in the soil, or it will make a hot mess of your rototiller blades.
The wool, but not the pellets.
Right, not the pellets, but the wool. Experience speaks there.
And you guys have, actually, you have, you're selling another product that relates to wool as a kind of a mulch?
Mm-hmm. We do sell the cleaner wool from my sheep as a mulching fleece. 1 pound covers about 9 square feet. So if you're looking for protection from slugs and snails or deer and rabbits or just an extra way to cool your soil and keep it moister, you can just put the raw fleece around. I do take it up at the end of the season and let it dry and store it in the garage, and then I can use it again for about 2 to 3 seasons.
And it's so it really does repel?
It really does.
Rabbits and deer?
Yeah, they don't like the lanolin in wool, the deer and the rabbits, but it's also a slug and snail repellent because the slugs and snails don't like the barbed fibers of the wool. So,
And that include the pellets too?
Yes.
So there you go, Dave. Did we answer all your questions there? Sorry.
Actually, just one little follow-up. I appreciate that. I lost the volume here. So if I wanted to take some wool from anywhere, I can just put it around the top of my plants on the soil, 3 inches thick. It'll work just fine and take it off each year?
For mulching purposes, yes. If you want to add the nitrogen and the other nutrients to your soil, then you'd be better off burying it in the ground, which is why we like the pellets, because it breaks down faster and releases those nutrients quicker.
Yeah. There you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate
Thanks,
your call. Let's go to Mary in Plover, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a couple of questions. Well, number one, I'm just trying my new tomatilla salsa I just made.
Yum.
But we're doing a big deck project, and I have to move a lot of my perennials, including peonies and lilies. What's the best time to move both of those? And they'll be going to a temporary spot for a while so I can move them back in.
So peonies and what was the other?
Lilies. I have various lilies.
Oh, well, you should be able to move those without. Yeah, go ahead.
Karen, you should be able to move those once the foliage has died down. You should be able to move them with no problems. I usually like to wait until the peonies are pretty well yellowed before I do anything with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that shouldn't be too long in Plover, I wouldn't think. How do they look now, Mary?
Where can I get these woolettes or whatever you're calling them?
Woolettes. You can find them at any of the Jung's stores. You can also find them at Wisconsin Weekly Harvest if you're online. You can find them at Ader's Hardware and Aspen Ridge Home and Garden in Mineral Point. Am I missing anybody?
I think you got it all.
Yeah.
But
or you can order them from us as well. Online.
Yeah, you sell them online.
We do. Yeah. We do. It's www.woolets.net.
So woolets, if I'm
Correct.
Not mistaken.
Yep. And .net.
.net.
Right.
So, Mary, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Carolyn in Madison.
Hi. My question is, if it repels deer and rabbits, how does it do with squirrels and chipmunks?
I don't think there's any research on that, and my guess is it's not going to work for squirrels.
I don't think anything repels squirrels. They have dug up my plants right around the wool and flung them willy-nilly.
Okay, so squirrels is not going to help much with squirrels, Carolyn, but if you got rabbits or you got deer, could be some help there. Thank you very much for calling. And Robin in Colgate, it's your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I'm just curious if it matters when you're looking for these mullets, does it matter how they're how the sheep are fed or farmed on the front end for what you receive on the back end?
Yeah, Karen?
Well, we do source from Wisconsin farmers, and we know our farmers. So we know that they are taking care to be raising with care and humane practices. So as far as that goes, you can be sure that, that these are well taken care of sheep. And as far as what they eat, you know, wool is wool. It's kind of like human hair. It's an organic substance, and there's not going to be anything that's given to a sheep raised with care and humane methods that would be a problem for anything in your soil or your plants.
Okay. Robin, does that help?
It does. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Carol emailed to say she has 10 full wool bags. wondering how much do you pay for wool and where can she take her wool to sell it to you, Karen?
Well, at the moment, we are full up on wool. I don't even know how many thousands of pounds we have in our garage. We have paid farmers for, so far, 11,000 pounds of wool this year. Although there's 80 pounds of my or 80 bags of my own wool in the garage, we still do buy. So we're full up for this year. Probably we'd be looking at buying wool again in the spring, and it's going to depend on the market. We have been able to pay up to 50 cents a pound, but it depends on what the market is running at that point and how many pellets we've sold. But you can reach out on our website, and it'll have a note on there when we're buying wool again.
And the website again?
www.woolets.net.
W-O-O-L-L-E-T-S, woolets.net. There you go. Thank you so much for that question and comment. Let's go to Marilyn. What is the ratio of woolets? Let's see, it's not worded quite the way I would have worded it, maybe. Marilyn emailed to ask what the ratio is of the amount of woolets to area and how big are the pellets. So we did talk about size, but go ahead, Elaine.
Yeah, if you have 30 square feet, 1 pound of woolets will cover that 30 square feet. If you're talking about pot sizes, if you're going to repot plants, you can do up to about a half a cup of woolets to a gallon of soil. Just always remember less is more. You can always add more woolets later, but you don't want to give too much nitrogen right off the bat, because we did have a customer who put too many woolets in her pot, and when she watered it, they expanded, and the plant lifted right out of the pot.
Oh, yeah. So best to follow the instructions
on
the package.
Yes, we do have a guide on our website to tell you how much to use. But I also want to point out that when you're repotting your plants at home or you're thinking about adding woolets, you don't have to repot everything. You can just take a chopstick or a spoon handle and just make a little divot and insert the wool pellet around the perimeter of your pot. And that way it saves you a lot of time and hassle rather than repotting everything until you're absolutely ready.
I'd say a pencil. A pencil end would be the perfect
size, right? It would be
about the put them in.
Diameter of a pencil eraser.
Yeah.
And you want to get that down in the root zone. So that's a good way to do
that. Down about an inch or two, maybe?
About 2 inches, I would say.
Two inches?
As far as pot sizes go, for about a 6-inch pot, I generally put about a tablespoon of pellets in is all.
Yeah. So that's not very much. Carol in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
My question is, what is the effect on the soil long term?
Yeah, so you're adding woolets over time. What's the effect on the soil, Elaine?
The effect on the soil is
is great. You have the soil biome that's being fed from the macro and micronutrients, and you have the aeration. So you're building that soil structure.
So there are macro and micronutrients within the wool pellets.
Yes.
And this is all, by the way, this is not, there's not something added to the pellets. It's
correct.
The wool itself, and I think you said it's the lanolin that when you heat it, it serves as the binder.
It's one of the
lanolin
binders.
Lanolin already in the wool?
Yeah, it's one of the binders. The scales also help hold the wool together. You know how wool can be itchy?
Yeah.
Right. It's those scales that kind of get intertwined and locked together.
Oh.
Yeah, wool has scales like human hair. They're basically made out of keratin, just like hair is. And so they kind of interlock during the process, and then the heated up lanolin holds everything together. One thing that I will mention is that if you're not adding organic matter to your soil, the soil microbes don't have anything to feed on. So if you're continually adding chemical, synthetical fertilizers or whatever, you're feeding your plant, but you're not feeding your soil. And eventually your soil biome is going to die off. And then your soil is worse than when you started. So they need a natural substance, and wool gives them that in spades.
Let's turn to Reese, who's on the road headed to Chicago. Hi, Reese.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm not in Wisconsin, obviously, do I do this, but I am a cannabis grower. So I grow indoors under high-intensity light. We have a very short and rapid cycle, and I'm wondering about Woolitz as opposed to peat and sphagnum moss. Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not actually certain what the question is, but...
Oh, wondering if he uses sphagnum moss in growing...
So can it replace it?
Yeah.
It can. You're going to need to be careful of your volumes. So a 3x8 compressed bale of peat covers about 76 feet, and 2.5 pounds of Woolitz covers the same amount. So like we said earlier, less is more. I have run a couple of trials with, you know, the same amounts of peat as wool, and it's a lot of nitrogen. It's too much nitrogen. So just start smaller. You could try substituting core, the coconut core fiber in. That's what I've been doing in my peat-free potting soils.
Yeah. But the pellets would work for producing cannabis.
Oh, absolutely. The every plant seems to like it. We grow it in use it in orchids, in cacti, in succulents, in fussy Boston ferns, you know, whatever. So just consider that your fertilizer and your moisture retention, but you won't need as much as you do with the peat. So that's why I was suggesting adding the coconut core instead of, you know, like in the amount that you would add peat and then add the Woolitz to do your moisture and your nitrogen.
Mm. Reese, does that help?
Well, it helps a bit, but we strangely, I think, and not typically of crops, we have found that if you hit the drying, if you dry out the media each day and water again, that's the best for production and rapid growth.
Oh.
So too much water retention is not beneficial. But to make it through the day, perhaps using less media might be useful. But how much, what is the cost as compared with peat and sphagnum?
In the bulk pricing that we use, Woolitz are about 20 cents per square foot, and peat was coming out at about 23 cents per square foot.
Okay. Well, there you go. And the and you can order... Reese could order online if he wants to give it a shot.
He could. If he wants to do bulk rates, he should send us an inquiry and we'll talk about how much he needs and how we can accommodate that. But we have done up to 1,000 pounds at a time for someone.
Okay. Reese, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly. We got open lines. Mary emailed. She lives in northeast Wisconsin, very sandy soil in the woods. They've lost a lot of trees due to storms, so the front ditch of their property is full sun now, and she'd like to plant the typical natives you see along the roads, goldenrod, asters, Queen Anne's lace, chicory, etc., for pollinators. Any suggestions regarding reasonable seeds for those plantings? So she's got some area, wants to know suggestions regarding reasonable seeds.
And this is Mary?
Yeah, Mary.
Mary, I would start collecting seeds at the side of the road because then you know those seeds are going to make it in your area. You could also try Prairie Nursery. Neil DeBole has some great seeds out there. Prairie Moon Nursery also, I think, is a prairie place. But I would start on the side of the road, gathering your own.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea because, you know, if they grow there, those seeds are going to work.
Yeah, it's local.
It's because it's local. So there you go, Mary. Thank you for that question. Jean emailed that there's conflicting advice on fall hydrangea care. Should the blooms be removed in the fall or left until late winter? She has Zinfandel and little lime varieties. yeah, there is some question there, I guess. I think, well, I don't know. Go ahead, Karen.
I got nothing there, Larry. My hydrangeas never, I haven't found the good variety yet for my place. So you can take that one. Thank you.
well, and we were talking about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, and the guest that particular day said she, it's sort of a personal taste thing. Some people like to clean things up, and so they take those blooms off, and others just leave them. So I'm not sure there's an advantage one way or the other, and at least that guest said personal choice is probably the best. So there you go, Jean. Thank you. Dave has his own wool and is wondering if it has to be cleaned before it's used, Elaine.
You want to make sure the wool is not cleaned. You want the raw wool right off your sheep. That's the best.
Oh, so, and why? Why is it the best?
Because we need that lanolin in order to do the pellets. We have tried to do clean wool off of a show sheep, and it just is sand. It doesn't stick together.
Okay, so that because the show sheep is
was washed and
washed,
you know, all
and cleaned
up for,
and,
yeah,
and all the lanolin
went away.
Lovely
wool, but it wouldn't stick together for anything. So that's when we realized, okay, it really is the lanolin that holds all this together. So,
all right, JJ and Madison will give you a chance. Hi, JJ.
Hello. This is kind of in line with the person who asked about organic, and my mind immediately went to vegans. And so I was curious what you would think, or if this was something you've already addressed or thought about, in that, you know, it's an animal product being used to grow whatever. But if it was potentially vegetables and things, would that make it non-vegan?
That's a good question.
I can't imagine it would.
You know, I mean, the animals aren't harmed, but it is an animal product. So,
but it's going into the soil.
But it's going into the soil. It's not,
and the
soil is being applied to the
plants. Yeah.
But the product itself is breaking down into its elements, right?
Correct.
And the soil is absorbing.
Right. So you're feeding the soil.
Yeah, the soil is absorbing
the nutrition.
The nutrition and breaking down the elements.
And then the plants are absorbing that nutrition from the soil.
The plants aren't directly absorbing the animal part itself.
Right.
Listen, JJ, we're speculating here. I can tell you that right now. But to my mind, you would be breaking down to the basic elements of the material. And it has ceased to become...
By that time, it's no longer an animal product. It's basic nitrogen and carbon and whatever. So
yeah. So I think That's the way we go. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking as well. And I know it's a very semantic-y kind of question, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I just wanted someone else's thoughts.
I'm glad you brought it up. Something worth thinking about. And I think we got the right answer for you, but...
We haven't had that question before, so it's good to have something new to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling. Margaret in Shorewood, we'll go to you. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Hi. I have an extensive orchid collection, Phalaenopsis, Dendrobium, Paphlopedilum. What would be the ratio of orchid bark mixture to these things if I want to replant?
I don't know what the exact ratio would be necessarily, but like in my orchids, I put about a tablespoon in each pot. I have some of the really chunky, barky, you know, chunks of wood sort of orchid material, and I have put a tablespoon and a half in there because it drained so fast. And I am a notoriously lazy waterer, to be honest. I mean, that's one of the things I love about the pellets is that I can forget and my plants don't die. I did notice that I was able to salvage a couple by adding about a tablespoon and a half in. I think it's something you'd have to play with. If you have a soil mix or a soil-less mix that has more small bits in it that are going to hold more water, then maybe you don't need as much wool. But anything that is very chunky, I think you'd want a little bit more wool in.
Yeah. All right.
Does that answer it?
Yeah, so in a 6-inch plastic orchid pot, a tablespoon with the big bark.
Yes, I think that would be about perfect for you.
All right. Thank you, Margaret, for calling. Appreciate it. Dot in Chippewa Falls, your turn.
Hi. I do not go online. I don't know how. I was wondering if you had a telephone number that I could call to buy these pellets.
Sure.
Well, you could call me if you like. It's 608-228-3603. Generally, just leave a message and I would get back to you. But if you're near a Jung store, you could actually pick one up there. They have them in all of our store at all of their stores now.
And Jung's is all over the place. Mm-hmm. All over the place. So it's nice to have that. But the number again was 608-228-3603. Did you get that, Dot?
Yep, thank you.
All
You're
right.
welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org as we visit with our two guests, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew. Their business is called Woolets. And Jill let me know she's been getting some calls for people not being finding the wool, the website because they're using one L instead of two. So Woolets, it's two O's and two L's. Woolets. Apparently, if you only use one L, it's not going to come up.
Right.
And .net at the end, too.
Right.
Woolets.net.
Correct.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So I've got that out of the way. John in Dodgeville, thank you for calling.
Yes, my question was if you could put Woolets on your yard, of just areas of my yard that don't hold moisture for whatever reason.
I think that's a great idea. In fact, I was thinking that we should contact some grass seed companies and see if they want to put grass seed with Woolets to broadcast, because I think that would not only help the seeds grow, but also build the soil right there. So I say do it.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Of course, you wouldn't want to run your lawnmower over it after you just laid it out there, but...
Well, the pellets are shredded up, so
yeah.
Even when they expand, they're just fluff at that point. It's not going to bind up into anything with that point. It's if you use raw wool without being shredded that it binds up.
Yeah, I was thinking of it blowing away.
Oh, typically, you know, it doesn't.
No, as soon as it gets wet, it expands, and then it kind of adheres to the ground.
Okay. John, does that help?
Yes. How densely would you spread it?
I would go with 1 pound covering 30 square feet. And then if it looks like it's not holding enough, or if you're spreading your seed a little thicker, you could add some more to it. You'd be our first test with that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I might give it a try.
All right.
Let us know.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, here's an email from Kate, who says she has lots of holy wool socks. Can she cut them up and use them in the soil? Well, now, wool socks it depends, I suppose, if they were 100% wool.
You can. You can cut up wool sweaters and whatever and use them. Cut them up small so that they have, you know, a chance to break down. But if you would be better off with 100% wool socks. Because if they have any sort of, you know, the nylon or any of the other spandexy type things, then you're just adding plastic to your soil.
Somebody might wonder, you know, you are also kind of a weaver, and are you not?
No, I'm a spinner and a knitter.
Spinner and a knitter.
Right.
And you're using wool for that, and somebody else might say, well, why don't you just use it all for that? Why what kind of wool are you using here?
Well, there's a lot of different grades of wool. Historically, sheep wool was sold and processed into garments and blankets and rugs. And with the development of synthetic fibers, wool, as a general rule, became a valueless waste byproduct of raising sheep. Most of the 300,000 pounds of wool produced by Wisconsin farms gets thrown away or burned. A lot of it is not suitable for spinning into yarn or weaving or whatever. So that's a real big waste of resources. So I do have, as many of us do, we do have special wool that is suitable for spinning, but then there's a lot of junk. You know, any of the meat breeds are not going to have the best wool for spinning. So that wool's got to go somewhere because we have to shear the sheep. So that's why we use what we use. Also, most of the wool buyers that are out there now are paying about a penny to 2 cents per pound for wool. So it's not really worth it for the farmer to try and sell it because it costs them $6 to $10 per head of sheep to shear.
So you're paying farmers more than a penny.
Right.
So what's the current price?
We have been able to pay 50 cents throughout the year. And as I said, we've bought about 11,000 pounds of wool so far. But we're full up, and so we'll have to see what it'll be in the spring when we need some more wool.
Yeah, of course, but that's 50 times.
Right, right.
What they would have,
correct.
Well, they would have thrown it away.
Right. I mean, there is still a wool buyer down in Illinois that buys a lot, but they won't buy any black wool. And they won't buy any wool that's too dirty. So we're able to take even the really dirty, yucky stuff. Mm-hmm. And we actually like the colored wool. It makes really pretty dark pellets.
Yeah.
And I love the aspect of diverting a waste product from the waste stream. If we can divert more products from the waste stream and use the resources that we have, we're doing a better thing for the environment. Everyone can benefit from this.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, the mulching fleece and the wool shreds, you're selling shreds too? I'm not sure what's the difference between a mulching fleece and a shred?
Well, the fleece is from the entire animal, or you know, it's not broken up at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just from the shearing process. The shreds are from our first process of putting them into the shredder, the fleeces into the shredder. So it allows for a little aeration in the soil. It allows for water retention, nutrient release. But the difference between shreds and pellets is the shreds haven't been through the heat treated process.
Oh, yeah.
So you might have weed seeds.
Yeah. So
I think you get more bang for your buck if you are putting the pellets into the ground, because that's about six times the amount of wool in a shred that's compressed down. So for nitrogen and nutrient release, you want to use the shreds in the ground, the pellets in the ground. But the shreds are nice if you just have a couple of plants you want to protect from slugs and snails. You can sprinkle the shreds around and make a little barrier and they won't cross that. You can use it in your pots to fill up the holes in the bottom of your pots.
You know, I'm looking at your I'm looking at your packaging, which is nice.
Thank you.
And I like the something special from Wisconsin seal on it, as on every package that. But this, so the packaging is pretty cool, and but it, this is you don't have hundreds of employees running around out there doing this work. It's kind of
it's just us.
Just the
and we both have full time jobs.
Yeah.
You both have full-time jobs, and you kind of make do a little bit. I mean, the product is there, and the product's good, but some even if a box, you get boxes from wherever you can get boxes from to when you're shipping.
Yep, mostly the schools. I'm fortunate to work at a school, so any boxes that are going to be recycled, I scoop them up and bring them to our shop.
Sustainability is very important to us in our operation. So, you know, we use paper tape if it's, you know, unless we're shipping out something that is too heavy for the paper tape to be able to do it, but or to support it. But we try to be sustainable in every aspect. Any wool that we're processing and we can't use it, it's got too many burrs or, you know, giant tags or whatever, that goes gets composted at my farm so that we are as zero waste as possible.
Yeah. How long does it take to compost that?
I don't know. I don't really turn my compost pile.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah, I have. Well, I have a barn full of compost, that, you know, barn debris. So, yeah, we keep thinking we're going to do that. But after a couple of years, I just fish out from the bottom and go use it. It's great. The lazy man's way to do that.
Oh, man. So what are your plans? I mean, are you going to, is it this way you're going to keep going? I mean, how many people, how many of these could you... You're probably going to get some orders today. I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Well, that would be super.
Very exciting. Mm-hmm. Our vision is to have a place that's not a corner of Karen's workshop and George's workshop. And my vision, and I've talked to Karen a little bit about this, is to be on a main street and have a storefront with a shop behind where we can store the wool. It could be a net zero building. Fingers crossed that we could do some kind of solar and just be a very sustainable operation, doing the best for our environment that we can.
I would like us to be able to get bigger machines so that we can do 500 pounds an hour.
Yeah, what can you do now?
On a perfect day, about 45 to 50 pounds an hour.
50 pounds an hour.
A lot of the problem with the pelleting, why it's not perfect, is that wool has to be a specific moisture level. It has to be between 10 and 15% to pellet well. Otherwise, it just doesn't. So if we could do larger machines, move things a lot faster when we're having a good moisture level day, that would be a lot better.
How do you check the moisture? You stick a...
We do have a moisture meter, a textile meter that, you know, we got off Amazon. Yep. And then we use that Amazon box to ship out some more pellets.
And sometimes we're just running the wool through, and when I pelletize it, if it doesn't pellet right, then I have to wait for it to cool down a little bit, pellet it again. If it can absorb some more of the water or release the vapor. So it's a trial and error every time.
Now, if you stick it in some pots in your house, is it going to, you know, wool may have this doesn't smell, it smells like wool, but is there an objectionable? I can't imagine there is.
Within the pots, the product doesn't smell at all.
Yeah,
once it's in the soil, it doesn't smell.
You're taking your pencil and digging those spots in around the edge. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Elaine and Karen.
Yeah, it was. Thank you.
And I really appreciate your time, and I think it's a great business. I love what you're doing here, and hopefully we can get a report from you down the road. You're going to have to tell me if you sell any woolets today as a result of this program.
I have seen a couple of orders come in already, so thanks very much.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
We appreciate being here, Larry.
Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew, and their business is Woolets, and two O's and two L's there, woolets.net. You're going to find it. And coming up, we're going to switch from wool to apples and take a look at heirloom apples. I'm Larry Mueller.
across the orchard in the bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree.
Oh, that's the song Apple Pickers, Real. And it was written back in 1966, Jeff Robbins tells me, by Larry Hanks, who worked picking apples in the 60s in California. And our guest probably knows that song, Dan Bussey. Do you know that song, Dan?
I have heard it. I have heard it.
Dan knows a lot about apples, too, and that's why he's with us today. He has written a 7-volume book on heirloom apples. And the official title is The Illustrated History of Apples in the United States and Canada. Yeah. How many?
Well, in the book is about 16,350 distinct varieties.
16,000. And some beautiful photos.
Yes, the USDA commissioned watercolor artists back years ago to paint pictures of apples because that was the only way that they could probably get a lifelike rendition of them to compare with stuff that people were sending them constantly.
We're going to talk a bit about this book, but really zero in on apples today. And I think there's very little that Dan doesn't know about apples. Oh,
you might be surprised.
And growing them. And you may have all kinds of questions for him. Could be anything from growing apples to, you know, problems with them. But then just questions about heirloom apples. And your history, I really do want to get into how you got so involved in this, because I think it's such a great story. Here you are, a guy from Edgerton, Wisconsin.
Yep.
And you grew up amidst an apple orchard, if I'm not mistaken.
The old family farm orchard. Right? My dad put a house right in the middle of it, so I was always surrounded by the old trees. I wish I knew what most of them were, but, you know, when I was a little kid, it didn't interest me all that much. You know, I could grab a couple of green apples and bounce one or two off my brother's head when he wasn't looking. that was about as interesting as it got. But later on, I realized that I grew up with these wonderful heirlooms around me, and I had no idea what they were, and I needed to know. What were those?
And how did you go about doing that?
Well, I guess it came down to the point where I was getting married, and I bought a little bit of land, and I was going to plant fruit trees. And I just happened to be reading through the old Blair and Ketchum's Country Journal magazine, I think in 1979, and it had a book review in it for a book called Apples and Man. It was written by Fred Lape. Lape was the director of the George Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York, and it's just a little book, but it talked about all the old varieties that we used to know and were very popular in this country years ago, and we've forgotten about them. We've moved on to newer and supposedly better things, but the old ones still had a charm and a taste that is superb and is worth looking into, and it got me hooked. The names especially are what really got me interested. All the sheep nose and cow snout and cat's head and white astrakhan and all those names. Like, what is that? What's that? What's about that?
And the story behind those had to be, so you looked into not only the...
I looked, yes. And that's the fun of it, is looking at the stories, not just the apples, but the stories behind them, the stories with the people that these apples originated from. And that's been really fascinating. I will be doing this the rest of my entire life at this point.
Well, you've been
I'm
at
not
it
done.
For a while. I mean, you've been at it for what?
Basically since the late 70s. So I started probably, 79 is when I really got interested in apples, and I started looking for old books on apples, and I would come up to the university up here at the Steenbach Library, because I remember doing study halls when I was a student here, and I remember there were old books on apples, and I thought, okay, here's a place to go look. And for over 15 years, I'd grab a grocery sack full of old horticultural manuals and take them home and scan through it. And I did that for years and compiled it. I bought a 286 computer to try to keep track of all of this, which I guess had about a 40 megabyte hard drive. I think my smartwatch has probably got more memory than that does.
Oh, but you kept using that computer. And
yeah.
And so it's not only just finding every apple.
No. You learn the history of fruit culture in this country and wonderful stories of American history along the way. I think that's the fascinating part to me.
It would be to me, too. Michael in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi. Thank you, Michael.
Hi, Larry. I want to thank you for the programs that you air. I listen to them quite regularly. And I want to thank the guest for the discussion and all the research he's done on heirloom apples. I'm just calling to kind of make a statement for the other listeners that there are heirloom apples out there, which we all the listeners are aware of, at least now. Many of us have also heard of heirloom tomatoes, which is pretty much the only type of tomato that I eat. They're kind of malformed sometimes and kind of ugly, but they have incredible flavor.
Good for you.
But there are two other, there are two other products that are not well recognized yet. There's heirloom corn. So, again, it grows shorter. The ears are smaller, but the taste is fabulous. And there's a local company that makes a tortilla chip out of heirloom corn, and it's absolutely dynamite. It's different than anything else that you can buy off the grocery shelf. And there's also heirloom pork, believe it or not. There are some farmers who raise these old varieties of pigs, which grow very slow and they're very small. You know, which is not favorable to the modern hog farmer because they want a pig that grows fast and grows to be super huge because they make more profit that way. But the heirloom pork also is completely different than any type of regular pork that you can find on the shelf. So I just want to highlight that to all the listeners. And I'm welcoming all the heirloom products because they truly offer more unique flavor than some of the more traditional stuff that you find in the grocery shelf.
And, Michael, you're going to have to, those chips, you're going to have to give us the name of that company because we're going to get questions.
Okay. Well, so here's the problem. I'm kind of older, and my memory is not what it used to be. But I don't actually remember the name of the chip, but I can tell you where you can buy them if that's okay and doesn't violate any program rules.
All right. Where can you buy them?
At the Vitruvian Farm Outlet in Stoughton.
Oh, okay. Well, Stoughton. That's where I was born. Stoughton, Wisconsin. Vitruvian Market. Okay, Michael, thank you. And if you learn any more, shoot me an email and we'll put it up on our page and let people know.
Michael, I'll do you one better. I actually had some pork last year, heirloom variety of pork that was raised on heirloom apples. They were fed at the end. So you get the combination of that wonderful flavor that apples can give to pork to finish them off in the season.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. And you're certainly agreeing with everything he said.
Absolutely.
For sure, Dan. Holly in Ogama has something for us. Hi, Holly.
Yes, I grew up, my mom planted a wine sap, a Macintosh, and a Cortland, the two latter ones have long since deceased, but that stubborn, wonderful old wine sap is still existing since 1954.
All right.
Where in the hell can I find a wine sap to replace it if something should happen? I can't find a wine sap tree to plant.
I can tell you where they are. There are a number of nurseries that still carry the wine sap. It's still a treasured variety. It's not going to get lost. It's around. So you can reach out to me, and I would be happy to set you up with a couple of nurseries that would carry it.
And how will Holly be able to do that?
Well, let's see. I think you can, I'll give you an email address. It's ciderdan@gmail.com.
Ciderdan@gmail.com.
Ciderdan is one word.
Ciderdan is one word.
I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Holly there. Well, what about, could she take the seeds from that apple?
Nope.
I mean, it's an old apple.
The only way to keep it alive is to be able to graft it. You have to vegetatively propagate it to be able to keep it the same. Because the apple is still the wine sap, but the seed that's in it is whatever crossed with it to pollinate it. So it'll be partially wine sap, but partially something else.
So, but Holly could...
She could plant the seed and...
the way that you suggested.
If we graft it, it'll be exactly the same tree.
So she could graft it onto another apple tree?
Yep, onto another apple tree, or we could start with a new apple rootstock. I teach grafting classes. I've taught for over 38 years, and there's different classes that I do around the state, and we can set you up.
Holly, thank you so much for calling. I'm now blanking on the title of the book that I read this past year. It was just one that I read for fun, and it's about some apple trees that were planted and sort of the history of a couple 300 years in the existence. And there's a panther on the cover of the book, and I can't remember the title of it.
I can't either. I think I've seen it. I've not read it, but
it was a very interesting because those particular apple trees produced supposedly the most delicious apple in the world. And anyway, in the meantime, you hear the whole story of that particular area of Northeast Wisconsin, of Northeast U.S.
Yeah.
Over the course of time. Well, somebody's going to call in and there's a panther on the cover.
Well, that's a start.
I can't remember the title of the book. And it's been many months back. So anyway, Peter in Appleton, thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Could you tell us anything about the story of the Wolf River apple?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I dug into the Wolf River apple because the stories that have been around it have all been somewhat right, but a lot wrong. And so I've been able to fix that. What happened is it's been attributed to a man by the name of William Springer. He was told to be a Quebec lumberman. Well, that's not quite right. He actually was from upstate New York. And during the winter, a lot of farmers, when times were slack on the farm, they would work up in the lumber mills or lumber fields. Wisconsin had a lot of that going on. And he worked in Quebec lumbering trees during the winter time. But later on, he decided he wanted to try his fortunes west, and he took his family on a wagon, and they headed across the United States and ended up south end of Lake Erie, where they bought a bushel of apples to eat along the way, and he told his family to save those seeds because we don't know what we're going to find when we get to where we're going. And so he eventually ended up just west of Fremont in a place called Evanswood near the Walla Walla Creek. Anyways, a couple of years later, he ended up squatting on land. They call it preempted. that's the fancy word for it. But he squatted on land at the south end of Partridge Lake, which is a widening of the Wolf River just west of Fremont. And he planted the seeds of these apples and had a nursery going. He was quite the avid nurseryman. But he sold this tree to a gentleman who had a farm on the east side of the Wolf River, on the east bank. The name was always attributed to a guy by the name of Henry Rifflin. And I tried to hunt up Rifflin in all the census records, and I couldn't find anything. Turns out his name was actually Rieflund, a German man. And once I found that, everything kind of fell into place. He died fairly early. There was a notable book put out in 1869 by Charles Downey. He was one of the preeminent pomologists in the country. Anyways, he said that this apple came from the farm of the late Henry Rifflin, and that's where I first got messed up with the names. And so what happened was Rieflund died fairly early. His wife then married a man by the name of Joseph Stiegler, whose name was also misspelled in all the literature. It was, I think, called Steiger. And so we had a time just coming up with the right names. So Rifflin is the man who raised this tree, got it to fruit, the neighbors loved it, and he was the one that named it. Not Springer.
There you go. Peter, you got what you needed to know there. Thank you so much for calling. Oh, man, we're having some fun talking about heirloom apples today with our guest, Dan Bussey. He's the author of a 7-volume book, The Illustrated History of Apples in the United States and Canada. Took him a long time to write and put this together. And how many pages have we got here? 3,000 or something?
Yeah, about 3,000. Yeah,
About 3,000 pages in this 7-volume. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along on WPR News for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Monday, by the way, I want to just mention our physical therapy experts are going to be back to answer your physical therapy questions from 11 to 12:30. And then at 12:30, we'll talk with a therapist about relationships and intimacy. That's on Monday's program. Right now, we're taking a look at heirloom apples with Dan Bussey. It's great to have him with us. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And the name of that tortilla company that produces the tortillas with the heirloom corn is La Cosecha, C-O-S-E-C-H-A, La Cosecha Tortilla Company. And several people have called in to let us know. Steve in Sun Prairie has something for us. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hey, I had a uncle, my most senior uncle, actually, graduated with a master's in agronomy from UW in the 30s and moved out to New York. And according to family legend, he developed the Duchess apple out in upstate New York someplace, around Poughkeepsie, I believe.
What was his name?
Yeah. Paul Meyer.
And the Duchess apple. And when would that have been? The 30s?
He graduated UW, 30s. Probably in the 40s and maybe going into the 50s.
Well, we've got a historian here, Steve, so let's see what Dan's got to say.
Duchess is actually a very old apple. It came from Germans that had moved into Russia, and it was brought into, I think, back into England, and then got here about 1835. So it's one of the really old-timers that's got kind of a dual history, both Germany and Russia. There are Duchess seedlings, which your uncle may have contributed to, so I can't... There isn't one just Duchess. There are seedlings and sports and different things, and he may have developed something like that.
Oh,
but the true Duchess apple, the Duchess of Oldenburg, as the full name is an apple that's been around a lot longer than all of us here.
Okay. Steve, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is, I was born in Wisconsin, but grew up in Leominster, Massachusetts. And local lore was that Jonathan Chapman, or Johnny Appleseed, came from Leominster, Massachusetts.
Yep.
I'm wondering, what do we know of him, and what types of apples would he have been sharing?
Ah, that's a wonderful thing. There are more books written about John Chapman than almost anybody I know, even Trump, I think, at this point. He was a very interesting character. I love reading about him. He is one of those iconic American figures. I know Disney has sort of made a version of him that I think it's not quite true to form, but you know, gave us an idea of what kind of a person he was. He was a Swedenborgian. That was the religious sect that he sort of followed. He did not believe in grafting apples. That was abhorrent to him. The only thing he would do was collect apple seeds from the cider mills in New England, and he would travel up and down the Ohio River, and he would start nurseries using these apple seeds. He sometimes bought the land, sometimes he didn't. But that's how people moved in those days, is upriver. And so he set up nurseries. And the rule was at the time, if you were going to homestead, you had to plant apple trees. There were speculators buying land that would buy it and then mark it up and sell it to somebody else that make a big profit on it. Well, they didn't like that. The government didn't care for that. So they said, as long as you're planting fruit trees, that says you got to take care of them. You got to be there to do that. So he set up nurseries, sell to these people that were moving upstream. And by the time he died, he was one of the richest landowners in the Ohio River Valley. I think he got as far as Fort Wayne, or I think where he passed away. But he's an amazing figure, very true to his form. The Native Americans didn't quite know what to make of him, so they kind of left him alone. Mm-hmm. And he would warn settlers in case there was possibly an attack or something coming. So he was a friend of both the Native Americans and to the early settlers that traveled through.
And a lot of the apples, one piece of history that may or may not be true was that the farmers often used the apples for like a hard cider.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sometimes the water wasn't actually safe to drink. So the cider was a beverage that everybody had. I mean, kids had a pitcher, you know, glass of cider before they went to school or worked on the farm. Politicians would have a glass of cider before they went to work. And I think a few of them now could probably use a glass of cider before they started their day. But cider was the national beverage and it was around. But at that time, it was around probably 4 or 5% alcohol, not particularly strong. So it was a pleasant beverage, really easy to make. They would make barrels per person capita, I think, in Massachusetts for drinking. I'm trying to remember some numbers to that. But yeah, cider was the beverage.
Tim in Hollandale. Hello, what's on your mind?
Hi. As a kid, I used to go out to Prairie du Chien, where our family was from, out by Ferryville. And we used to get this apple called Talman Sweets. And I've been able to find it once a while back at the market up on the square. But I cannot find, I actually want to get a couple of trees.
Yeah.
But I can't find the apples anywhere.
Yeah, they're around. I have Talman Sweet in my collection. Seed Savers has it in theirs when I worked there for 6 years. And so it's one of the classic Wisconsin sweet apples that it was around. I bet there's a lot of wild trees still existing in Wisconsin yet. But it's available in nurseries. It's not the easiest to find, but it's out there. I can help you find those if you want.
And Seed Savers has them?
Yeah, it was in their collection.
Decorah, Iowa.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, there you go, Tim. Thank you very much for calling. Carl in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi, I'm curious if your guest, Larry, has got any familiarity with a variety called Rosé. My father-in-law used to grow apples in his backyard in Madison, and his parents were from the Soldiers Grove area, which is pretty famous for a lot of small orchards in that region of Wisconsin, and there are a lot of heirloom varieties there. And he knew of some rosé trees there that had been cut down. He gathered some branches and then grafted them onto his trees in Madison. But he indicated that might be the last of the rosé, and I just wondered if your guest has any knowledge of that variety. Thank you.
Actually, depending on how you pronounce it, it could be looks like rose or rosé. I think it was a Duchess seedling that was sold by the Mount Zion Nursery in West Salem in La Crosse County. It was known in the late 1880s. It was a variety out there. It's not one that I know particularly well, and if it is the true rosé variety, it's great because it's a lost variety as far as I know. It would be nice to rediscover that one again.
Yeah, there you go, Carl. So is that tree still in existence, or Carl?
The tree that he grafted those onto has been cut down. He sold his home, and the new owners cut down the tree. So yep. That might be the end of the line for that one.
It may be.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Ann in Duluth, Minnesota. Hello, Ann.
Hi. My dad used to grow what I think is an heirloom apple called Fireside.
Yep.
Okay. And he died about 30 years ago. They were so good. And I have only found them twice since, and neither time they just were not very good at all. They didn't even remind me of the Firesides that he grew. Do you know of any orchards that are specializing in heirloom apples? Now, I live in Duluth, so within, you know, like a day's drive or a few hours drive where I might be able to find them again.
I see Fireside apples here and there. One apple you might find, it's sort of a variant of it, is called a Connell Red. It came from Dunn County, and it's a red sport of the Fireside. It has the Fireside flavor, but it has an improved color. So it's technically a Fireside, and you might be able to find Connell Reds around in western Wisconsin, because it's a very popular apple. It has been for a long time. So that might be one source. I know of a couple of fireside trees in Decorah, Iowa. I pass by them every day, practically. And so it's an apple that's around, but it's a good one. It's one of the early ones that I first had, I think, when I was first getting into apples, was fireside. Really, a really tasty apple. Very nice.
And does that help?
Yes, thank you. Maybe I'll have to go to Decorah, right?
There you go.
I can tell you well, right where the
probably,
trees are.
Well, if you follow along the Mississippi River there, you're probably going to find an orchard or two that has the fireside before you get to Decorah.
Yeah. I know of some, I'm going to give a shout out to a couple of orchards that I know that have heirloom varieties. I'm going to say John Kring and his wife from Suamico have Maple Valley Orchard Nurseries. That's great. Bill Stone from Brightonwood Orchards in Burlington has a lot of heirloom varieties. And Weston's Orchard in New Berlin also has a lot of heirloom varieties. And I bet you they've got fireside as well. So there's a couple really good people that are hanging on to these old, old varieties. And I know there are more out there, and I apologize for anyone I've missed, but that's the fun of it.
Oh, that's the fun of it. Ann, thank you so much. I want to go back to that book that I mentioned with the panther on the cover, and it was the kind of the history of this apple orchard sort of over a couple hundred year period, and Jeff Robbins found the title. It's the author's Daniel Mason, and the title of the book is North Woods, a novel. It's got a big panther on the cover, and Daniel was the finalist for the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
It was really a fascinating novel, Northwoods. So there you go. Dot in Manitowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Do all apple trees have to be sprayed because of the, the disease or the worms?
No. In the short answer, what there is if you have habitat for beneficial insects, they will prey on a lot of the apples, pests that are out there. It's not perfect. If you don't over-fertilize your trees, that will help because there are different diseases that strike when a tree is very vigorous, like fire blight is a really nasty pest. Well, I should say it's a virus disease, and it overnight can absolutely kill your tree. But I've grown apples organically for the last number of years, and I have more good apples than I have ones with spots or specks or whatever. There are just things that you get used to, like sooty blotch and fly speck, which is sort of a little fungus that's on the skin. It doesn't affect the flavor or the taste or anything, but it cosmetically doesn't look bright and shiny like you would normally see apples, but it doesn't affect the flavor whatsoever.
No. And you brought me a couple of apples here. What did you bring me? I'm just dying to crunch into one. But
this is one of the rarest varieties in Wisconsin. It came from Greenfield Township, just west of Sauk City, Baraboo area. It's called a Dockham Russet. I was able to find it in the Badger Preserve. That's between Baraboo and Sauk City. It's land that is co-owned by Dairy Forage Research Center with the USDA and the Wisconsin DNR and then the Ho-Chunk Tribe. We found a tree kindly through the help of the Ho-Chunk people that let us look through the property because we were looking for old apple trees on this preserve because of all the farmers that got chased off back in 1941 when they were going to build an army or an ammunition plant. And so the U.S. Army took over about 10,000 acres of land initially, and they only ended up using about 3,000. And they took all the buildings down, but they left a lot of the remnant orchards still in the area. So my friend Kurt Miney and Rob Nury and I have been discovering apples there for the last 10 years or so. And this is one apple that I've been able to identify. And it is a wonderful apple. It's a red russeted apple. Each year it changes a little bit. Really fine flesh, very nice flavor. But there is only one bearing tree that I know of in this country. And it's there in Sauk County.
And what's it called again?
Dockham Russet. D-O-C-K-H-A-M. It's named after the Dockham family that came from New Hampshire and settled in Greenfield Township.
Wow. Wow. That... Thank you very much. I can't wait to dig into it. But I don't know if I could keep talking while I was. Brandon in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Brandon.
Hi. I have, as a kid, there was an apple orchard nearby that had sweet 16s. And recently, I was walking through a nursery, and they had a sweet 16. I've got it for a couple of years, but it's not doing so well. I'm wondering, one, is it an heirloom? And two, what are things that I can do to help improve it?
It's a semi-heirloom. It's been around not that long, so, but it actually is one of the parents of Honeycrisp. So it's been around for quite a number of years. Keepsake is the other parent of Honeycrisp, but Sweet 16 is a really nice apple developed in Minnesota. And it's a nice apple.
Yeah, there you go, Brandon. Thank you so much. As long as we're talking about Honeycrisp reminded me. Now, I think those were developed in Minnesota.
Yep, at the university there.
Mm-hmm. And the apples from there, the Honeycrisp from there taste a lot better than the Honeycrisp from other areas. And I there's something to this, I think, isn't it?
Terroir makes a lot of difference. The type of root system that you grow your trees on can influence the taste of the apple. You know, the modern trend, of course, is to have these fruiting walls with very shallow dwarf trees. And those dwarf trees don't have tap roots that much. That really can access the minerals deep in the soil. And that's what the older trees can do compared to the newer ones. So that's some of it. But also, if your trees are irrigated a lot, if you have an orchard that irrigates their trees a lot, and that happens, and you get dry years like last year, and you have to, you get a really wet year like it is this year, the flavors are actually much more muted than on a dry year. They've, a case in point, in California, they intentionally dry out the grapevines later in the season to improve the sugar content and reduce as much just water that's in the grapes themselves, and it improves the flavor and the quality of the wine. Apples are no different than that. I've had irrigated Honeycrisp that to me are just a shadow of what they should be, whereas a naturally grown one, with, you know, if it's a decent year and you don't have to irrigate, tastes so much better.
Yeah.
It does make a difference.
It does indeed. Scott in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Scott. Scott, are you there? Oh, I guess we lost Scott. His question had to do with whether or not you use genetic information to sort your apples out.
That's a process I'm working on. I'm working with a group from Washington State University and Fort Collins, the USDA station. And the man who discovered the true parents of the Honeycrisp, that was Nicholas Howard. He's actually from Dodgeville. And he's working overseas in Germany now. And he's put together a baseline of a lot of the heirloom varieties. And we're constantly expanding that. So when someone has a sample of an apple they want to try, they'll send us a leaf, a young leaf that's just come out. Mm-hmm. And we can determine if it's something unique or what its parents are, or if it matches what we have in our database, we can put a name to it. It's a constant ongoing process, but it's fascinating that DNA is starting to, we're finding out lots of interesting things. There's an apple that I discovered in Decorah, Iowa called a Yankee apple, Y-A-H-N-K-E. It came from Winona, Minnesota. There was a man by the name of Frank Yankee. It was the biggest apple tree I'd ever seen. It was at least 4 foot in diameter. And I thought this was an amazing apple. I saved it, and years later it was bulldozed down. But turns out it was the old Vermont variety called Bethel, which was planted in the upper Midwest. So DNA is making us honest again, I guess, as far as the people renamed apples, or you had an apple you lost the tag to, and what do you call it? So you give it a name. So this is going to simplify a lot of things.
Josh in Baraboo emailed that Stony Ridge Fruit Farm near Loganville has over 100 varieties.
Excellent.
Including Bloody Plowman. Yeah, so Josh says, very interesting if you're into apples there. They are only open weekends, and he believes he does custom grafting as well. So Stony Ridge Fruit Farm near Loganville, and They have the Bloody Plowman.
Yep, it's an old English variety. There's a long story that goes with that, and it's obviously not very good. But it is, it's one of those iconic English varieties, which I love.
Oh. Lisa emailed that she has a geriatric apple tree dying of old age. It seems like the taste of the apples has changed in the last 2 years. Is this a result of the tree's impending doom or the weather conditions for the past two seasons?
I would say it's more weather conditions than anything else. Most trees, even if a tree looks like it's really on its last legs, it maybe has taken 40 years to get to that point, but it may be around for another 40 years. But if you're concerned about it, let me know, and we might be able to graft it for you and keep it going. And the genetics will be the same. It will be the same tree again.
But, oh, so you could do that.
Oh, yes, we can do that. A lot of things we can do is to do a little bit of pruning on the tree to invigorate it. You can take a tree that looks like it's about half dead, and by getting rid of the dead wood and cutting off some of the upright sprouts and encouraging the outer branches to grow, that's where you produce fruit buds, and your tree all of a sudden can kind of come back to life. It's not always perfect. You never cut more than a third of the tree off at any one time. But generally, if we can get a little cutting of it, we can keep that tree alive.
Mm. Do you have a website?
No, I wish I need to. I need to at this point. I've been told I need to have a website. So I guess it's one of those things. I'm sort of a Luddite, and I'll get around to it at some point.
But in the meantime, you do have an email address if she wants to get a hold of you.
Absolutely. And I'm always happy to go talk apples with people wherever they are.
And it's Cider Dan?
Yep, one word. Cider Dan, CIDERDAN, @gmail.com.
@gmail.com. There you go. And I tell you what, here we go. A reminder that we're talking today with Dan Bussey, an expert on heirloom apples and the author of the 7-volume, The Illustrated History of Apples in the United States and Canada. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at heirloom apples on the program today with our guest, an expert for sure, Dan Bussey. His 7-volume book, The Illustrated History of Apples in the U.S. and Canada. Quick reminder, next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers will be back to talk about getting your garden ready for winter, so I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, questions about apples, join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. John Bergman emailed us from the Stony Ridge Fruit Farm near Loganville, and John says he does have Fireside and Tolman Sweet at the Stony Ridge Fruit Farm near Loganville. So there you go. Suzanne emailed to ask if there's a plan to graft from the Dockham Russet.
Oh, yes. We've been working on that for a couple of years now, so we've got a lot of little trees started, and it's not going to get lost. I have it in my collection down at the Silverwood County Park, which is just southeast of Madison and the far southeast part of Dane County near Edgerton. I have a collection of about 600 varieties there, and we're going to be planting the trees. I've got them in the nursery, and we're going to be planting them out. And so it's a community orchard, and you can come and pick apples. It's not ready yet, so don't come on out. But it's a wonderful place. It's a lovely park. That it was from land donated by a school teacher by the name of Irene Silverwood. It's a beautiful place, and a lot of things are happening there, so it's going to be fun. But the orchard's coming along. It'll be about 12 acres, and you can sample any of those 600 varieties when they come into fruit. And if you like them, we can graft a tree for you or help you out. I'm going to start teaching classes on cider making and apple pie baking and all that good stuff. So we're going to have some fun.
That sounds absolutely great. You really do have to get a website.
Yeah, I do.
For sure.
Yes.
And you mentioned 600 varieties, and you were telling me before the show that you've got a book. You'll be coming out with a book on Wisconsin apples.
Yeah. I put one together called The Apples of Wisconsin, an exploration of the apples that call Wisconsin home. I've been able to track 623 varieties of apples that originated in Wisconsin. I mean, most people probably know of but 3 or 4 maybe, but that many originated in the state. And I have a history of the people that introduce them and grew them, and it's been a lot of fun putting this together.
Oh, man. So, when you get that book ready to sell, you got to come back.
Okay.
And be on the show. Or is it a long way off?
Oh, I hope it's going to be pretty soon. It's pretty much done, but I won't put a panther on the cover.
No, don't do that. Oh, man. Tony in Highland, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. My wife and I, one of our favorite apples is called an ambrosia. I'm not sure if it's an heirloom or not, but we were visiting one of the orchards in the Kickapoo Valley and asked them about it. And they said that it is a Canadian apple and that there is some sort of Canadian mafia or something that won't allow you to buy the tree to grow here in the United States. Is there actually something like that?
I've heard of ambrosia. It's around. I don't think it's one of those. You know, there are plant patent rights, and that is probably the biggest thing that probably keeps a lot of people from growing some of the newer varieties is because of that. I swear I know people that are growing the ambrosia. It's a pretty good apple. But yeah, they're trying to control the market for them, so they only allow so many people to grow them, and you have to pay for the privilege of being able to do that. We call those country club apples. And it's kind of a bane in life, but you know, I understand it's about marketing. I was a one-time president of the Wisconsin Apple Growers Association, and really it's about marketing and making things available to people, but you know, we have to make a living doing this, so it's part of the process.
So it's not really a mafia.
No, not really.
Okay.
It only seems that way, I guess, if you can't get it.
Nancy in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm originally from New York State near the Finger Lakes, and my folks always used to talk about Northern Spies. I haven't seen that out here, and I was wondering if it is available.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Northern Spy is a wonderful apple. The only kicker about Northern Spy is it takes a long time for it to bear. Mm. On a semi-dwarf rootstock, it takes 10 years to get your first apples. So it isn't planted as much as it used to be. I mean, it's the classic New England pie apple, and it's a wonderful apple. I have a tree of it. It took me 10 years to get one apple finally, and then after that, it bore a lot. But it's a great apple. They have it at the Seed Savers Exchange, and it's a wonderful tree. It's a great apple, and I wish more people planted. But if you're trying to make a living off of this, it takes a while before you get your first paycheck.
There you go. Well, pies, do certain types of apples make better apple pie is an email question.
Northern Spy is a classic. A lot of people use Golden Delicious, of course. My mother was a home ec teacher, and she taught her sons to bake. Considering our dubious employment or marital prospects, at least we wouldn't starve. So I don't make a pie unless I have probably about three varieties. Now, if you don't know what to do with an apple, hold it in your hand. Does it feel heavy for its size, like a cue ball, or is it light like a puffball mushroom? The ones that are denser and heavier tend to stay firm in a slice. The ones that are softer tend to cook down. So I like to mix the firm slices with ones that make a sauce around them. And then if I can get it, a red-fleshed apple for color. And then you've got like the perfect pie. Now, ambrosia is an interesting apple that came out of the 1980s, and it was from British Columbia, and it was assigned to a particular nursery. So I think that's probably the reason that you're not seeing it around. It's been tested in Iowa and different places in the 40s, but a different one. But it's around. It's been protected. That's why you're not able to find it very awesome. So I just wanted to backtrack and mention that. I happened to look it up here in my little book.
Sarah in Rosendale has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I'm looking for recommendations, really, for a good softer meat apple, I guess I should say. You can find an apple that is kind of grainy when you eat it, and that's not necessarily something that's loved by the family.
Yeah, or I missed part of that, I think.
So. Yeah, can you repeat that first part? I missed it, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just looking for recommendations for a softer a softer meat of an apple.
Okay.
I guess. Not something that's so grainy for the meat part of it.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of an issue. Sometimes if they're softer, they typically have maybe a little coarser grain to them. Yeah, like yellow transparents, they're really a soft apple. Macintosh are probably one of the softer ones, and it's fairly fine grain, and they're just in season right now. So just good old Macintosh might be a possibility.
Yeah, there you go, Sarah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Roxy emailed that there are a couple of orchards in the Chippewa Falls area that have Connell Reds.
Yeah.
For the lady who called from Duluth.
Yeah, that's where you'd find them. And it would be your fireside taste, but with a little brighter red coloring.
So Chippewa Falls is fairly close for her, for the lady who called earlier.
Yeah.
Brad emailed that he lives on a portion of an old orchard, in Door County, about 15 plus trees, variety of varieties. He hasn't really done anything with them as far as treatment. Is there a way to bring back to production or to check if it's worthwhile to bring these trees back?
Yeah, I think it doesn't take that much. You just need to look at the tree. And when it's time to prune, it's look at getting rid of all the deadwood that's there and getting rid of a lot of the vigorous upright sprouts, because that'll encourage side branching, which is where your fruit is going to come from. And you'd be surprised how these trees can sort of just all of a sudden seem rejuvenated. It takes a couple of years, about 3 years, to get that to happen. But a little bit of work that you put into it will pay for itself.
Joel wonders, what apples make the best apple cider?
There are so many different kinds. I got into sort of the trap that I was going to grow all the old standard European cider varieties for making hard cider. And some of them work pretty well. But a lot of them are very touchy. They ripen pretty early and they drop. I have been scrounging apples in the wilds of southeast Minnesota, and we have found more wonderful cider apples just from... a cider apple typically is a smaller apple because you have a larger skin to pulp ratio. And the tannins, which give your cider character and mouthfeel, are in that skin, in those tannins. So by having a smaller apple with a lot of skin, you get that, you can get more tannin extraction. But mix as many different kinds as you can find. If you can find russet apples, they by themselves have probably some of the best flavors possible. Mix as many different kinds as you can, because what one lacks, another one will pick up. But look for some of the smaller ones that are kind of nasty to eat. Yeah, that's going to give your cider a little bit of zing, and that's a good thing.
And then what do? You got all these apples.
Well, if you can find a way to get them juiced, that's wonderful. And cider is one, hard cider, I should say, is one of the easiest things to make. It requires just clean containers, good jug, and if you can find some type of cider yeast, there are different kinds. You can use British ale yeast. You can use some of the special cider yeast. And you put a fermentation lock, of course, to keep the air out and let it bubble and froth. It gets pretty crazy the first couple of days, and then it settles down to a lot of little bubbling. And when the bubbling kind of is done, you can put a little priming sugar in your bottle, use a beer bottle. You can't use a wine bottle because they can't take any pressure. But if you have like a champagne bottle or a beer bottle, they can handle so many bars of pressure, and you can bottle it and then enjoy it all winter long. It's simple. It's really simple. The more you know how to make it, the harder it is.
Oh, man. This has been a lot of fun, Dan.
Oh, me too. It has. It's a treasure.
Well, I definitely want you back. And when that book comes out on Wisconsin, that would be the perfect time. So get that book out.
Yeah.
Quick.
Yeah. Okay.
And thank you for the apples, and thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Oh, man. Dan Bussey, his book, well, he's got the 7-volume history, the illustrated history of apples in the United States and Canada. An amazing collection and book, and I have really enjoyed looking at least one of the volumes. There are a lot of volumes, 7 of them. Thanks to him, and thanks to you for listening in. And stay with us. Lots more in store here. Remember, we've got a great team effort here with Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Of course, our boss and executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.
Hey ho, it makes you feel so fine, looking out across the orchard in the bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree.